Okay, the real news is I get to have lunch with the coolest, smartest officer in Starfleet, Barbara Brinson, who also happens to be my girlfriend. That's right. Oh, we met a month ago and it's just been magical.
Oh boy, here we go. Log number 1,000,000 about girlfriend Barb. You know, I am sorry, but I'm starting to think that Barb might not actually exist.
Oh, she's real. She's as real as a hopped up Q on Captain Picard Day.
Let me guess, when we meet her, it'll weirdly have to be on the holodeck.
Hey, I don't do that anymore.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the animated bridge,
this is Tyler Orton making a Kirk Sunday with Trip Tucker sprinkles.
Who would be another funny actor to throw in place of Trip Tucker?
With regards to sprinkles?
Sure, yeah.
I think Geordi LaForge sprinkles. Any sort of good engineer. B'Elanna Torres sprinkles. I could get some Torres sprinkles for sure.
I would go with Chakotay sprinkles because I feel like that kind of sounds, it sounds right.
It's a kind of a dreamy sort of person in your eyes.
Sure. And just like the word, the sounding of Chakotay sounds a little like chocolate. So it kind of makes sense with the sundae metaphor.
How about a Kirk sundae with Trip Tucker sprinkles and Chakotay sauce on top?
Boom. You just nailed it. Why aren't you on the Lower Decks writing staff?
I don't know. I'm fending off offers. And clearly, I think they might be trying to make enticements towards you and I. We got a visit from the USS Vancouver this week, which was a lot of fun. Cam, I just have to think, you and I were both based in Vancouver, and it was just cool to see the name of our city represented. But it got me thinking, like, why would they want to pick, you know, a USS Vancouver? Because I think it has a different connotation to it than if they called the ship of the week, you know, the USS Cleveland or the USS Paris. What do you think that they're trying to elicit from audiences by calling it the USS Vancouver, this Parliament-class ship?
Well, I think in this episode, and we're going to be talking about Cupid's Errant Arrow, I think when you name a ship after that, you want to kind of emphasize maybe like a city that's sort of recognized as being, you know, like a top tier city, like a place that really people think of as maybe a ideal living condition or something like that. But I think when you say, you know, as you said, Paris or New York, there's a lot of baggage to that. It becomes almost too iconic. Whereas like, I feel like Vancouver, it's acknowledged a lot, especially post Olympics here, but it's not like throwing out, you know, London or something like that.
Yeah, I wonder how many of the American audiences really pick up on kind of the connotations of Vancouver that you'd get in Canada, where I think across Canada, Vancouver has a reputation of being kind of the laid-back city where everybody thinks we're all kind of cool, that sort of thing. But it's also kind of the yoga city, what have you. I don't know how many Americans can tell the difference between Winnipeg versus Vancouver. It might all just be the same, but these are Hollywood people putting the show together. I think there's tons of these writers. They've been to Vancouver before on jobs. I haven't spoken to many Americans that have visited Vancouver and don't absolutely love it. It is gorgeous. I'm a little biased, but I think I'm being objective. We're right on the sea and the sea is right against the mountains. The architecture, I find it a little sterile, but it's just kind of the city of glass, and it is quite lovely, and I think that's what they are trying to elicit by giving maybe Subspace a shout-out as well with the USS Vancouver for the entire episode.
Either Subspace or just the fact that the animation studio that they use, Titmouse Studios, is in Vancouver.
I think that's probably the more likely scenario there. The other thing I did enjoy, though, is the shuttlecrafts featured in this one. They're all named after different city or different neighborhoods within the city. So you had like the shuttlecraft Marpole, the Fairview, and the Kitsilano. I thought that was kind of funny, but I was scratching my head as to why the Marpole. Like, that's it's kind of a insignificant sort of neighborhoods. Kitsilano is cool. Fairview is, it's where the hospital is. I was just a little, were those just random neighborhoods you were throwing out there, Cam?
Well, do you think they just kind of looked at a map? Because, I mean, I guess Marple is noteworthy for Subspace fans who have been listening to this podcast for a long time, because a lot of our early episodes were recorded in Marple. But, yeah, I just wonder if they pulled out, like, maps and looked at, I don't know, semi-major neighborhoods? I don't know.
Well, they must have visited here. If they're going to go through the effort of calling the USS Vancouver, you'd think that they'd, like, kind of figure out, like, well, here's a hip place, or because there's so many different neighborhoods and far fewer obscure neighborhoods. Like, I would have thought, like, what about the Shuttlecraft Yale Town, or the Shuttlecraft Gas Town, or the Shuttlecraft Mount Pleasant, or something like that, right?
Okay, I gotta back you up here. I'll say one thing. Yale Town maybe sounds a little too similar to Yorktown, so maybe that's the reason there. But the USS Gas Town?
That would have been pretty awesome.
I mean, I feel like there's some good jokes you could get out of that ship, but I don't know if they're going to go with the Gas Town.
Well, for those that don't know, because they're not really into Vancouver history, but it's named after Gassy Jack Dayton. He was one of kind of the founders of that area there. He was like a bar owner. He was the Al Swearingen of Vancouver's day. And to call somebody gassy back then, it meant that you were just really talkative. So that's why it's now called Gas Town. But there's a little history lesson for y'all.
That's right. And if you ever come to Vancouver, you want to visit there to see our ancient steam clock, which has been there maybe 20 years, but people think is hundreds of years old.
Yes. But let's get into the meat of this episode, though. I don't know about you, man, but this is my favorite episode so far of the season. She seems as if the writers have kind of this confidence about what they're doing. They really have nailed down what works, I think. And this is just one example, but I didn't find the story to be as, you know, busy as we've kind of noted in previous weeks. We had kind of more of a balanced story between the four lower decks, those characters there. And I just kind of, I liked how this episode kept subverting my expectations, where I thought it was going to be kind of a cliche trope of, you know, Brad getting jealous because he's got like a girlfriend who has like her own romantic past as well. What's your initial takeaway from this one, man?
Yeah, I think this is the best episode so far of Lower Decks. What I loved was, as you said, it managed to give all of the, you know, Lower Decks characters a lot to do, but it also balanced a captain's story as well. We had three stories going on all together at the same time, and this episode didn't feel frantic. It didn't feel like they were racing over details. It didn't feel also like they were cutting one story, you know, unnecessarily short. It just felt like everything was balanced in a perfect kind of functioning episode. And I was kind of impressed and a little bit frustrated about some of the episodes we found a little bit too fast paced, in that this one made it look easy. Whereas I looked at past ones, which maybe only had an A and a B story, and they felt super frantic. So I don't know.
One of the things I did appreciate, though, is they didn't have to have like this big climactic action sequence towards the end, which to me, I kind of get bored during those situations. This was the climax of this was kind of the character moments, where we finally have, you know, Mariner, who's incredibly paranoid about why one Barbara Brinson would ever be interested in one Bradward Boimler. You have Mariner launching herself to the orbital platform, which looked really cool. And she and Barbara, they kind of have kind of, it's not an action sequence. They talk it out. They figure out that they both have paranoia about the other one. And I like it when Star Trek climaxes with people talking.
Yeah. And I mean, I thought that, as you said, this could have been the most hackneyed episode yet. Like, this could have been modeled on any number of bad sitcoms you've seen, or bad 2000 era romantic comedies, probably starring Freddie Prinze Jr. or some variation on the stars of that era. We've seen that sort of hackneyed material time and time again. And I really appreciated that Lower Decks not only found ways to get a fresh angle on it, but also work in a very Star Trek-y story, a la something like Conspiracy or, you know, what have you.
Now, what did you think of the ultimate kind of twist where it's actually not Barb who is the weird one? It's the fact that some love parasite has attached itself to the back of Brad's head, and he's emitting pheromones now.
Well, I loved it because, I mean, it was a surprise I'd never saw coming. And I don't tune into Lower Decks for, like, you know, to have the rug pulled out from under me by the end of the episode. You know, different shows, you know, you look at for different things. And I never looked at this as a show that was going to give me kind of surprise endings. And the fact that I got one and that it was effective and that I never saw it coming was just like a bonus. I mean, I walked away from this episode loving all the character stuff. I think one story doesn't work quite as well as maybe the other two, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But overall, it's really tough for me to grumble about a lot in this episode. It's interesting in that, you know, when you look on IMDb, it's the highest rated episode so far. I can totally understand why. And by a significant margin too. And, but I've seen other critics say it was the weakest of the batch. And I'm just like really fascinated about what different people are looking to this show to deliver, because it delivered exactly what I want.
No, I'm in the same boat. I think we're interested in similar things from Star Trek, and it delivered for both of us. One of the other things that I do appreciate is the love interest. Often in Star Trek, they're portrayed as rather one-dimensional or uninteresting, but I liked having, you know, super competent Barb and with layers on top. And the fact that it's revealed at the end that Barb was actually very paranoid about Mariner this entire time. And I think with good reason, because Mariner, that's another hilarity going throughout this episode, because like I loved how Mariner was getting more and more deranged about the thought about why Barb would even be interested in Brad. But the thing is, they reveal Barb to be like a layered person as well. And the fact that she insisted that as a Starfleet officer, she would not succumb to pheromones, but she still decided to break it off with Brad to focus on her career right now.
I also thought that this twist with Brad having the parasite did a lot of good to in making Mariner look like a very capable character who was on the ball through the episode, because I think if you end it in a different way where she was just paranoid for no reason, it doesn't make the character look good. Whereas in this case, it actually serves all of the characters, and they all come out, we all have a certain amount of affection for all of them throughout the story.
And she knew something was up, not just because she just thought, oh, wow, Brad's such a total dork. There's no way that he could get a girl. Like, I think intuitively, she just knew that there was something wrong here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, it shows that this character has a strong sense of intuition, even if it's portrayed in a comedic way in this, of just looking at Brad Boimler and rolling your eyes.
I do appreciate that Gillian Jacobs from Community fame. She played Britta on that show, one of our favorite sitcoms. I just like her comedic styling, and so it was great to have her in the role of Barb. And I don't know, maybe they'll find a reason to bring her back in. But I do see that kind of Dan Harmon connection with Mike McMahon. He is a creator of Lower Decks and did Rick and Morty with Dan Harmon, the creator of Community. So yeah, that was kind of an extra bonus for me when I was going through the end credits, and I didn't recognize her voice as I heard it throughout the episode, but I did recognize that whoever the actress was a good comedic actress.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that has to sit for the credits of like a Pixar movie just to hear who the voices are, because unless it's like a, you know, obvious one like Danny DeVito or something like that, Robin Williams back in the day, I'm not going to necessarily be able to recognize a voice. But I think that this show has done an interesting job with its sort of celebrity guest cameos, because you are guest appearances, because yeah, you had Gillian Jacobs here, you had Haley Joel Osment last week, and in both cases they were very much grounded in a character. It never felt like celebrity of the week coming in to do a voice the way that, say, like a show like The Simpsons has done for a long time, and really, you know, they benefited in their own way. But I like that this show is making it more, who fits into this Star Trek world? Who is going to fit this character?
I just want to say, if they hired Danny DeVito to do Barb's voice, I would have loved that even more, though. Just putting it out there.
No. Well, I guess maybe him and Rhea Perlman will show up as like an alien couple at some point or something.
I can dig that. I can dig that. Like the ones that remember it at the start of Insurrection, where Picard was welcoming them into the Federation, the rather diminutive aliens?
Sure, yeah. Well, or even, you know, in this episode, Captain Freeman is talking to a group of aliens about a moon they're going to demolish or whatever. And like, there was like one of the aliens had like this really almost exaggerated, like kind of New York, sort of Brooklyn kind of accent. Now, I should also note, My ear for accents is very poor, so I apologize to anyone from Brooklyn who is offended by me saying it's a Brooklyn accent. But nonetheless, having Danny DeVito or Rhea Perlman voice an alien like that would be really funny.
Well, it's interesting because, look, you watch Star Trek and you don't really care if, like, a Romulan has, like, an English accent or some alien has, like, an Irish accent or whatever. So why can't aliens have, you know, like, Northeastern United States accents? You know, why not, like, a Rhode Island accent or something, right?
Sure. Well, exactly. And it's a way of showing, too, that these aliens are from different regions without trying to invent, like, different alien accents, which would be a nightmare.
I just think it's they get to choose what accent they have on the Universal Translator. It's up to their own choosing, right?
Oh, good call. Good call. Yeah.
So one of the other cool things I think people are may have excited some people, but we got to see a couple of those Deep Space Nine pylons at the very least, and the same class of ship that Mariner was serving on a couple years ago. It was featured in Star Trek The Next Generation, All Good Things, USS Pasteur. That was Beverly Crusher's ship as captain. I just love the design of that vessel. I'm glad that we got to see the same design show up in this one. What did you think of Mariner's flashback sequence? You even got the first contact uniforms and everything.
Yeah, and the acknowledgement of the events of Descent, the two-parter from season 7 TNG, or season 6 finale, season 7 premiere. I thought that was really funny. I guess maybe the timeline's a little screwy there. I don't really know. But I thought it was so fun to see them once again play around with Star Trek iconography. The old uniforms look fantastic. And just, I love how this show can do that. We can have flashbacks to, you know, an era like this, and it all looks proper. Like, it doesn't feel weird. Like, I think if, you know, we had, like, some, like, flashbacks in Picard, it would look weird. Whereas in an animated show, you can do it and it all holds together really well and it feels consistent.
Well, we did have flashbacks in Picard. Remember when it was right after the synth attack and we had Raffi and Admiral, then Admiral Picard. They even gave some de-aging special effects or VFX to Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Because I think it was like 13 years in the past or something like that.
But don't you think it would look weird if they did a flashback to, say, like, the timeline of season 7 TNG and tried to put Patrick Stewart in there in the old uniform?
Well, they did in the dream sequence with Data.
I feel like dream sequences open up the doors for that a little better, though, because there's something surreal about that moment. Like, if they just played it completely straight.
I totally get what you're saying. It would be a little disconcerting.
It would feel probably a little bit like the finale of Enterprise.
Do you think we're just gonna have Jonathan Frakes peeking behind everybody in that flashback?
Well, in my perfect world, yes.
I also just kind of like the idea, like, Mariner, she has had kind of her own career. She's had her ups and downs, and I also like how the animators went about depicting that as this episode progressed. And you notice, like, she got, like, bags under her eyes as she's going through this elaborate chart of different Star Trek aliens. Her uniform got a little sweatier. You could tell that this paranoia was just keeping her up at night. And I just love kind of how much thought the animators are putting into the design of all these characters as well.
Right. Like, the character designs on the show are relatively simple, but I love that they're finding ways to use visual grammar through animation to touch, in this case, into the character's, like, mental state. I thought that was smart and very, you know, simply done, but sophisticated. But I have to ask, the wall of aliens, did you have any favorites that stood out?
Yeah, probably the Dauphine. That just made me laugh more than anything else. Like, that was probably my favorite. What about you?
I really laughed at the changeling from the animated episode, The Survivor, from the 1970s original animated series. That one made me laugh, as well as, like, the android that looked like Lol in her unfinished form. Both of those, I'm just like, this is a show that, like, we referenced off the top of the episode of this podcast about the Trip Tucker reference as well. Is this show going to run out of references? Because it just seems like they're hitting so many obscure. I'm just, like, really fascinated what Lower Decks, assuming it keeps going for a while, like, what references we're seeing in, like, season 5. That fascinates me.
They have 800 hours, but probably more, of Star Trek to comb through to get references. The fact that they're bringing up the Dauphine yet again, that cracks me up.
Wow. Like, I love that we're getting references to episodes that we had absolutely no hope of ever hearing referenced ever again. I mean, yeah, if you watch, say like TNG episodes later in the show or some of the other shows, they'll reference things like the events of Best of Both Worlds, for example, or maybe like Measure of a Man or something. But you're not going to see a reference to like the Dauphin or like the Survivor from the animated series. Or, you know, we got a Justice shout out in this episode where they reference like, you know, people in sexy people in rompers running around. Like, these are not episodes that a live action show would probably reference.
No, that's totally true. I also love the reference to something like Requiem for Methuselah with, again, because Mariner thinks, well, hey, Barb must be an android lover, not like a real human being.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Like, and I guess that ties into the android lol kind of thing on the wall. Like, this show just seems to have so much fun with its references that I continue to be fascinated at like how obscure this show is, but also that it's being, in theory, shown to a general audience.
Yeah, because, you know, I would also say that the references, you don't need to get them to understand the story. And there might be like jokes that go over your head, but I don't think in any of these situations, a general audience is going to say, well, it's not funny because I don't get this reference. They're just not even going to realize that there was a reference there to get.
Right, yeah. Like, the Marvel Universe has done a really good job in translating something very geeky and filled with very labyrinthine continuity and translating that to an audience. But I feel like it tends to hold back on like the obscure comic book references that a lot of the audience would just scratch their heads. Whereas I feel like this show has really embraced its own dense, incredibly dense mythology.
Oh, Cam, I just remember walking out of the Avengers with you, and they had the stinger at the end with what's Josh Brolin's character in that movie?
Oh, Thanos, yeah.
Thanos, and it meant absolutely nothing to me, and you were like pretty charged up about it. I just had a blank stare on my face. Like, those are not the obscure references to general audiences that we're talking about. This is kind of a different thing, right?
It is, yeah. It's funny you say the Avengers, though, because you're talking, of course, about the 1998 film with Uma Thurman.
Yeah, it's all about weather patterns, man.
That's right. But no, it is a very different way of tackling references. And I know that I've seen interviews with Kevin Feige of Marvel saying, like, we don't really want to kind of do that, you know, go that obscure. But I really like Lower Decks for doing that. And I don't know that the average casual viewer is enamored with it. But as a Star Trek fan who does a podcast week to week, it's giving me things I never knew I wanted.
Well, and let me maybe bring up some of the comments that I've been making in previous weeks about the comedy style of the show. I was getting a little, impatient. Or I thought some of the comedy, if you're just supposed to laugh because they made a reference to Star Trek, that, like, to me, that's kind of cheap comedy. And you know how like a band goes up on stage and they're like, we're so happy to be here in, looks at card, Vancouver. And then everybody cheers because they hear the band say the name Vancouver.
It's I hate that.
To me, it's like, one example would be like last week, Brad made a joke about Moriarty. And I was just like, is that like an actual funny joke, or are people just laughing because like, oh yeah, I know Moriarty? And so that's the sort of stuff that I was going back and forth on. I think this is a show, and you get that with a lot of series, so you kind of have to be trained to know how to watch it and know what they're trying to go for. It took me a couple weeks to kind of figure out what they're going for, and I'm on board now. That's why, if he's talking about Kirk Sunday with Trip Tucker Sprinkles, I dig it. I don't know if every single, general fan of Star Trek knows who Trip Tucker is. I think most, general audience fans are people that are just familiar with TNG personally.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, I think that reference works well because a casual viewer picks up the Captain Kirk part. And that's enough.
Maybe it leads them on to Memory Alpha to find out who this Trip Tucker is.
Or they at least make the connection as to what that means, because they know who Captain Kirk is. So it's like, okay, well, I guess Trip Tucker is the same kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't want them to become over-reliant on the references as a means of comedy. I'm totally down with kind of the throwaway lines with that. And speaking of throwaway lines, I think my favorite moment in this was just a complete throwaway line where we have Brad walk into the mess hall dressed up in what the computer created as the sexiest clothing possible. And he's acting like a total dork in there. And finally, Barb says, like, look, you come in here looking super sexy, but then you started acting weird. Her just like off the cuff saying that, yeah, he looks sexy in that. Like, that made me laugh really hard.
That was my favorite line of the episode, I think. Like, that was absolute genius. I just thought that was just perfect for that character, because like a lot of shows would just play it up as he just looks stupid and is a loser.
Yeah.
And I like that, because, you know, this character is attracted to him, she thinks he looks amazing.
Yeah, but of course, he was wearing a boy's size small, which that made me laugh as well.
I would like to know the real world height of Brad Boimler.
Well, yeah, that's a very good... Maybe when we get the Danny DeVito episode, there'll be some sort of reference that we can figure out and do some math.
Yeah, I need to see the all four characters standing side by side, and I can gauge this. I need to look up a photo after the episode or something just to try to figure this out, maybe.
Maybe it's Commander Ransom, though, is the one that is just overtaking everybody in the height department there.
He's got to be like 6'2", right?
Probably. Is he Riker height?
I think he's, yeah, probably in that kind of ballpark.
Yeah, but not quite there with the Chakotay sauce.
He can dream.
Okay, so the other storyline that we were following, though, it had to do with Rutherford and Tendi. I'm inspired to bring it up because one of the jokes, though, is they figured out Lieutenant Commander Ron Descent's password, which was Riker. That was kind of weird. But how did this storyline work versus, I guess, the A plot, which involved Mariner and Boimler?
I like the idea of it, of these two, you know, tech nerds really just geeking out about the USS Vancouver. I don't know that the comic premise of it works fantastically well. Like, the idea of two characters obsessing over a mundane job, that works. And, you know, this equipment they've got, what is it, like the eight or the T-88s? Sure, I can go with this. But in terms of where that story went, it kind of comes out of nowhere, and I don't feel like it was... It felt just kind of like, we need this story to go somewhere. Let's throw something in.
It didn't feel earned by the time you got to the end and you found out that Descent just wants to get off the Vancouver because it's too stressful. They didn't build up that character or his motivations enough. They just kind of threw it at you at the very end. And you know, it just, I don't think the payoff quite worked for me.
Well, like Descent there is a... He's not really a character. Like, we don't know anything about him.
No.
Like, I think they should have found a way. I don't know. I mean, I'm complaining about how this show has been busy and that this was a perfectly paced episode. So maybe I don't want more character development of that character, because then we might be rushing through other stuff. But I wonder if there would have been a way to introduce the main characters of the Vancouver, so we had a sense of their personalities up top, like, because we do meet the captain of the USS Vancouver. I wonder if we could have done something there just to get a little bit of sense of his personality, maybe with the captain versus what he's like with them. I don't know. Like, it's a tough one because it is a busy episode, but the way it's delivered, it just doesn't quite click.
Well, I do appreciate, though, that that Rutherford was recording the commander's meltdown by the end with his eye implant. That was a good gag from my perspective.
Would it have been funnier, though, because we know Rutherford has like a lot of malfunctioning implants and everything. Would it be funnier if we had like a point of view from inside, you know, looking at basically the screen of what he's recording that says footage lost?
Yeah, no, I think so. That would have been great.
Yeah. Hire me, Lower Decks, too. Why not?
Yeah. The other story, though, the one kind of dealing with Freeman on this diplomatic mission, similar. We get these kinds of stories with, TNG. I like this one. It's kind of, you find out by the end that there's this one civilization that has exactly two people. It's essentially somebody's, like, planet in which they just summer there, apparently, you know, it's in like they're willing to let all these other planets crumble just because they got their floors redone. I like how Freeman just kind of looked at the guy and they're like, yeah, let's implode this moon.
Sure. It's sort of like when Marlon Brando or Johnny Depp bought like islands in the Caribbean after they'd really struck it, you know, rich. And that's the case here, where it's just like two people who are rich who own an island, and Freeman just like, ah, the hell with it. I really enjoyed this because, I thought of you during the story because it reminded me a lot of that episode from DS9 Progress with Kira trying to talk the farmer off the planet. And in that case, it's this very like heartfelt story about Kira trying to get this, you know, this guy to leave his home, versus here where we just get Captain Freeman being like, that's it, blow this thing up.
Well, and the thing is, like, we know that there's nuance within these kinds of stories with maybe you're talking about kind of, indigenous dwellers of lands or planets being uprooted. I get what Star Trek's trying to do when we've done similar stories. Like, we saw it with Journey's End. You mentioned Progress. Don't you feel as if you know every single beat that the writers feel obligated to hit in those kinds of stories? And then it just feels as if it's kind of a slog as I wait for them to go beat by beat by beat through this. It's just those stories haven't quite worked so well for me in Star Trek before. I liked how they wrapped up this one. It's just like, it would kind of react how I think the audience wants them to react here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in this case, we get to have fun with that type of story. Just the fact they are kind of these two just like rich people that are, you know, just obsessed with preserving their, you know, millionaire's home or whatever. So like, there's a good joke to that. But I was just thinking, like, you know, you referenced Journey's End. I think of the movie Insurrection as well.
Yeah.
Have these stories ever really worked? Because Progress doesn't work either. I'm trying to think, is there a case of this type of story that is like a really fantastic story?
Yeah. Remember when Worf's human brother showed up?
Oh, of course, yeah. You're right.
Paul Sorvino.
I stand corrected.
That episode was garbage as well. Like, yeah. They don't have a good track record doing these stories justice.
Justice?
Yeah. Sexy romper people that murder you for walking on grass.
Yeah, like I'm trying in the back of my head right now to remember if there was an original series episode that really made this work, but I don't think so.
The episodes, like, I'm not trying to minimize how this is like a real world thing that it is very much important, but it's just, they feel like slogs to sit through when you're watching them in Star Trek.
Well, yeah. And it feels like a type of story that's important to reference in a science fiction metaphor, because Star Trek and really great sci-fi likes to tackle issues of the, you know, the world as we know it. And so, like, I completely understand why they go to these stories, because I think it's a worthwhile story. I just don't know that they've ever pulled it off or found a way to do it where it doesn't feel almost like they have to be earnest to the point of it being kind of a slog, as you said, to get through.
Yeah, then I think there's a real opportunity just moving forward with Lower Decks to kind of continue poking at those tropes that are very much prevalent throughout Star Trek and kind of go down to those wells and just kind of poke fun at what Star Trek often does. And, you know, again, don't make fun of it, but I loved how, you know, Freeman resolved this. Yeah, you know, it's just very, it's like how I think audiences have been screaming at their screens through most of those episodes that we just mentioned.
Now, here's a question for you. We saw in this one, Freeman is just like, blow it up. What live-action Star Trek captain do you think would be the most likely to also consider making that call or make that call?
I'd say either Sisko or Janeway.
Yeah.
Sisko, because I just keep going back to that Eddington episode in which he poisoned the atmosphere of the McKee base. And I also think that Janeway is just one of those captains who's just like kind of, she's pragmatic. I'll say that.
Right, yeah, and she is quite willing to make tough calls. Like, Picard would never do it, I don't think.
No, and we'd be sitting there, it's kind of like a Journey's End sort of situation, right?
Yeah, and I feel like Kirk would show more exasperation about it. You know, I think of, you know, The Trouble with Tribbles or something like that. That's, you know, different type of episode, but just the way that Kirk responds to those sorts of situations. But I also think Kirk would probably make the humane call, even though Captain Kirk is known as kind of the two-fisted, you know, brawler captain or what have you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, a couple other things that jump out to me. The design of the ship, the USS Vancouver, I love it. I love the ship designs that we're getting a few of them, not a ton. I think just two new ones so far, five episodes in. But I think, like, look, if Eagle Moss, they're producing like a miniature of the USS Vancouver, I feel just obligated to get that and have that on my my desk, my home office desk.
Is Lower Decks producing the best, like, modern Eagle Moss ships?
I have not been a fan of the Kurtzman era ship design myself. It just hasn't really, like it seems too streamlined and very busy with the ship design, whereas I can look at the Lower Decks stuff and I'm just like, oh, it's very apparent in my head what it looks like. It seems to elicit kind of those classic stylings. Yeah, give me more of this. What do you think of kind of the ship's design that we're getting on Lower Decks versus the other Kurtzman shows?
Well, like I do, you know, subscribe to the Rick Berman belief where when they were designing DS9, that a child should be able to draw, in that case, a station, but he's referring also to ships. You know, I think a young kid who's watching Star Trek should be able to draw the Enterprise, or, you know, Discovery's pretty good, actually. A kid could draw Discovery.
For sure.
But like a lot of the other ships in the Kurtzman world, I don't know that a kid could just quickly, you know, draw that off in like a second. Like I could draw right now an Enterprise in about 5 seconds. That's not going to look good, but you would recognize it as the Enterprise. And I think that's a good model to stick with. That's something Star Wars always stuck to, with stuff like the Millennium Falcon or X-Wings, TIE Fighters. A kid can draw those super quickly. And I don't think you can really go wrong with that. And I look at the Lower Deck ships, they follow that pattern pretty good.
Yeah. The other thing I guess we should point out, though, is that we're officially halfway through the season at this point. Season one is going to have, I believe, 10 episodes. Yes, 10 episodes. Where do you think Lower Decks is? How does it work for you halfway through season one versus Star Trek Picard versus Star Trek Discovery?
Well, like Picard season one at this point, we're at our all-time favorite episode, Stardust City Rag.
Please don't remind me.
So if you ask me, and you probably did at the time, how I felt about the halfway point of the Picard show. Boy, I don't think I was too happy.
No.
At least I was very concerned because I think I liked episode 3 and was, you know, episode 4 was all right. But I remember episode 5 being like, uh-oh. At this point in time, I think Lower Decks looks a lot better than where Picard was at this point. Discovery was a weird one in that, like, you and I were both trying to figure out what that show was doing or what it wanted to be for the first season. But I also felt very engaged, pardon the pun, by what that show was doing, even if I didn't understand it. Like I was still hooked and jumping in, you know, trying to figure out the show. And so I feel pretty good about season one Discovery, even if I can completely acknowledge it's a mess, like behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But it kept me guessing. You know, I was getting episodes like Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, which would make me go like, oh, I think we may have some greatness on the, you know, in this show. So I think Lower Decks is, though, it really earns more points for consistency. Lower Decks week to week has been a show I know what I'm getting. I know what vibe I'm going to be tuning in for. And it gives me a lot of confidence, to be honest, that this will probably be the second best first season of a Star Trek show.
Yeah, and I think it benefits a lot from not relying on that mystery box storytelling that we got from Discovery and from Picard to an even greater extent, where you get to the end of the episode and you're like, well, I still don't quite understand where we're going or why I should be invested in it, because you get all these kind of like pieces to puzzles that you're, I don't know, supposed to go on Reddit and debate with people and try to figure out where it's going. And to me, I want them to tell, you know, whole stories within the episode and then have the serialized elements that still matter to us. Discovery's gotten much better about that. I think it's an issue plaguing Picard quite deeply, and I don't have confidence that the writers will change course in season two. But every single episode of Lower Decks, they have a beginning, middle, end. I'm following the character arcs. I know what's going on. It doesn't need to have kind of a serialized story arc to keep me engaged, keep me wanting to tune in week to week. I think it just seems so much more confident about itself and how it works within the medium of television. I get the sense that, like, maybe some of these executive producers of some of the Kurtzman shows, maybe they work in TV, but I don't know if they're watching a ton of TV and understanding what, you know, the best shows on right now are doing that makes them innovative in storytelling. And I think just relying on that mystery box storytelling device, it's really to the detriment of those shows' characters and just to the viewers as well, trying to get invested in what's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you can say, well, you know, it's a lot easier when you're Lower Decks because you're just more of a simple episodic show. But I guess I look more at the end game of like, well, I don't know which one was more fun to watch, which one was higher quality. and I'd say Lower Decks was both higher quality and it was more fun to, it's been more fun to watch for me than Picard. Discovery, it's a little bit of a toss up because I tell you, Discovery has a huge advantage because it was the first Star Trek show in a huge like gap of time. And it was the first Star Trek show I was ever watching in real time.
Right.
And so there was an excitement factor where my excitement for it was really carrying me week to week in a way that probably none of the shows that have come out since Discovery will ever benefit from. And I also look back at it with a certain amount of nostalgia just because, you know, you and I at that point have been talking about, you know, all the other series for quite a, you know, a number of years and the movies and everything. And the ability to tackle new Star Trek and place it within the context of the canon of Star Trek was so exciting.
Yeah. And I think, look, if we look at what the possibilities are for maybe Strange New Worlds, where they're promising it's going to be a little bit more episodic, that gives me a lot of hope that, like, just tell like a full story in every episode and you can have the ongoing serialized stuff in the background versus the alternative where, I don't know, like, can you just pop in, say, the finale of Star Trek Picard and have any clue what's going on or why you should care about anything?
I watched it in the continuity of the entire season, and I don't really know that I understood those things.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. I just think that Lower Decks is on the right track. I wish it had just been with us earlier, but look, they're obviously devoting a lot of money to Star Trek shows right now. I'm happy with the direction that we're going. We'll see if they can course correct some of the things that we have been complaining about with some of the other series, though.
Would you agree it's on track to be the second best first season?
Well, that's a really good question. Like, I guess TOS is the only competitor, right?
Yeah. I mean, that one is, it's going to be very difficult for any show to ever beat that first season of the original Star Trek. Just you look at the episodes in season one, you know, you got Space Seed Arena, City on the Edge of Forever. Like, those are episodes that are, most series aspire to get one of those. So
what are the competitors? I think if we wanted to throw it out there, I think we could make an argument for Voyager season one, yeah. Enterprise season one. And TOS season one takes the cake. Between those three, how would you rank those, though?
Okay, like, I feel like excluding Lower Decks from this, I feel like Voyager puts up the best fight. Like, yeah. And I'm not talking about Chakotay in the boxing ring. That's later in the series. But in season one, Voyager, it's a little rocky. And, you know, you could say the same thing about Enterprise. And I think I would put Voyager over Enterprise because Enterprise, you get a few more duds and it just feels like they're struggling with the concept of the show and they would figure that out obviously like gangbusters later. But season one, it feels a little bit kind of just doing more like Voyager stories, that sort of thing. Whereas I feel like season one Voyager, a lot of it clicks. You're hitting like a good caliber of episodes pretty strongly. Like there's a lot of good episodes in season one Voyager, and I know people often will say, like, to new viewers who are interested, they'll say skip all the Kes episodes, you know, join the series when Seven of Nine joins, you know, in season four. But like, I do think there's a lot of good episodes starring Kes or whatever, but also just during those seasons where she's a team member. I think maybe season two Voyager is where it gets a little lesser, but season one's pretty good. So go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say that the one thing that might sour people, though, is that it's a very weak finale, like learning curve.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst, you know, season finales. I think it can make an argument for the Will You Take My Hand from Discovery season one. But I think the difference, though, is like that's actually bolstered by the appearance of the 1701 at the very end of it, whereas the episode itself was a real dud.
Right.
But I definitely think that Voyager deserves kind of a lot more recognition for that. It's season one output, especially when Star Trek kind of has that reputation of taking a couple seasons to really find itself.
And you'd agree the Voyager season one is stronger than Enterprise season one, right?
Yeah, ultimately, yes. It also benefits from the fact that Enterprise season one, they just had to produce a lot more episodes. So you're going to get like more, the pacing of Enterprise season one was also very strange as well. Like a lot of those episodes would just kind of drag on and you just watch, you know, Archer get beaten up again and again and again. I'm mostly thinking of the Andorian incidents, yeah.
Well, here's a question for you. Both those Voyager Enterprise had tough first seasons because of ongoing arcs that didn't really work. What do you think is more successful, the Kazon arc in Voyager or the temporal Cold War in Enterprise?
I think ultimately the Kazon arc, especially it does conclude with Basics, which is a very, very strong two-parter. The temporal Cold War arc was just I never cared once, whereas at least the Kazon stuff, they did have some episodes here or there, even if they weren't the most compelling alien antagonists.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. And as you said, basically we get an ending to the Kazon story, and I have a sense in my head as to what that story was about. Whereas with Enterprise, I just recently watched the entirety of Enterprise. And I'm struggling right now to tell you what the temporal Cold War was about.
Yes. I and do you care?
No, that's the thing. I don't care. And the show didn't really care either by the time you got to Stormfront.
Yeah. So, so I'm wondering maybe a couple of closing things that I do want to bring up, just stuff that made me laugh or just kind of points. But I love finding out that Brad's full name is Bradward. And that Barb likes calling him Boim Boim. That was good. I also like how Mariner was convinced that this girlfriend that he was talking about at the very start of the episode, she's like, are you sure she's just not on the holodeck? He's like, I don't do that anymore. And then she said she was going to like put her hand through her. And she was pretty sure that her hand would go right through this holographic girlfriend.
Right. And after Barclay and Harry Kim and Geordi LaForge, holodeck love with the younger male crew members seems to be a very common thing.
Very susceptible to that. Also, my favorite
I can't imagine why.
my favorite sight gag, though, and I'm just a total cheap laugh, but when the very paranoid Mariner was on the shuttle bay and ran over to Barb and was like, look out for her tail, and then pulled her pants down. And like, I'm just such a sucker for pant humor.
When you get that awkward, just like long shot of her just like standing there. This episode had some fun with like those kind of silent, just image moments. Cause you also had Tendi and Rutherford imagining them bringing the T-88 back and being like heroes. And it's just like a snapshot. I thought that was pretty funny. A couple references I dug. One was Barb talking about resetting the timeline, you know, in 1920s Chicago. Which, of course, is a reference to a piece of the action.
But and she also said, yeah, like, no one is washing their hands there. That made me laugh.
Yeah, I thought that was fun. Very timely joke, actually, in some ways. But
true. Yeah.
The other one that made me laugh, and I very much appreciated, was Mariner offering to set up Boimler with a Phylosian. And now, we did an episode a while back before Lower Decks aired called Aliens We Want to See on Lower Decks. I think we called it Second Contact Aliens, but I'll post a link to that in the show notes. And one of the aliens that I really wanted to see was a Phylosian, which are these plant people from the episode The Infinite Vulcan on the original animated series. And we didn't get a visual, but we got a reference.
Yeah, no, it's just so crazy that you had brought it up just a couple weeks ago, and then bam, it's actually being referenced in the series now.
We must probably get a visual of one, right, at some point?
That'd be fun. I would dig it.
Because I haven't spotted it. I need to go back. I think it was friend of the show Scott Hardy actually said that one of the bird people from the animated series, there's like that episode, the Jihad, they're featured in. I think they're in another episode too. He said they were in the background of like that that settlement they went to in Envoys, I think.
Okay. Oh, no, that's cool.
I need to go back and look to confirm this, but yeah.
I also like finding out that Brad was accidentally peeing in an alien sink because he thought it was an alien toilet, and it took until somebody tried to wash their hands in that sink that he figured it out.
We've all been there.
Also, just Brad just being like the total like neurotic guy who he wouldn't stop saying the word lover, and then it finally just climaxes with him saying making love to my lover, and then Mariner's just like, please stop saying lover. Please.
Which is perfectly paid off with the parasite at the end being like, love her, love her.
Yeah.
I thought that was genius.
For and sure.
There was one line that I just loved was the dainty hipped nugget. That line made me laugh as well.
That could be your new WhatsApp nickname.
Who says it's not already?
No, fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Well, we're going to do episode 6 of Star Trek Lower Decks. As we record this, it doesn't actually have a name yet, but I'm sure you guys will know the name by the time we get there. So yeah, be prepared. We're going to continue doing reviews of Lower Decks every week.
And I should add, Cupid's Errant Arrow got the CAM stamp of approval for episode titles for animated Star Trek. And so I am hoping they continue that trend.
I dig. Yeah. That's let's get this CAM stamp of approval everywhere.
That's right. Okay. You can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at CAM, V is in Vancouver, USS, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REP, P is in Parliament Class, ORTON.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.